So whistleblower protection basically doing its job and protecting against whistleblowers as an organ of the deep state. Black becoming white. When we look with our eyes, these appear to be opposites that would not be easy to confuse. However, as I shall make the case throughout this show, particularly towards the end, that if we instead reflect on a symbolic, abstracted level, using words, using intellect and laws, then the confusion is easier to make. I'll just leave that point hanging there. It's not a small point. While, in case we think that the modern deep state phenomenon is an unprecedented one, no, it has a lot of historical parallels. For one of these, let's hear John Taylor Gatto on how it manifested in ancient Sparta.
Power in America has been displaced from its traditional locations into mystery, almost as if this were ancient Sparta, where serious decisions were similarly made in secret, even though there was a publicly elected legislature and executive.
So let's begin our examination of where the real decision-making lies in America with an explanation from Peter Dale Scott about why he came up with the term deep politics and what he means by it.
Deep politics is a term which I had to use to be able to conceptualize and write about what it was I had to say about the Kennedy assassination. And I did a whole book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and I said, I'm not trying to solve it, and I'm not even particularly, what does solving the case mean? Does it mean we find up the gunman saying, I shot the gun? That wouldn't answer the questions that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in who shot the gun. I'm interested in why the president was shot and what interests were served by that. And to look on that level, you have to look underneath the surface at things which are not acknowledged. So my definition of deep politics in that book is all those political processes that are usually repressed, not talked about, rather than acknowledged.
Now, since we're clarifying terminology, let's have one more phrase from Peter Dale Scott. This has been a useful concept on WikiSpooks, his idea of deep events.
We study things about the Kennedy assassination. It helps us understand, look for key points of similarity with 9/11. And may I say Watergate? These are what I call deep events. Events which happen and which we know we are not going to get a straight account of in the press, and they are presented as the actions of people who are very, very marginal and of no interest to historians. But my theory of American history is that, in fact, these deep events, and particularly the Kennedy assassination at one end and the 9/11 at the other, but also Watergate, all of them, the string of deep events, actually steer our history and are largely responsible for us being the warmongering power that America has become in the last 50 years.
Now, of course, I fully concur with Peter Dale Scott on the importance of these deep events. We'll be looking in detail at the JFK assassination. That was seminal for the US deep state. We're also going to be having a special look at the MLK assassination, which we've never really looked at in great detail on the show. I was surprised to learn, for example, that somebody had confessed to an involvement on that on television in the US. So we'll be playing a recording of that. And we're going to look at Watergate and the Amerithrax attacks as an illustration of how the deep state operates. Now we continue with Lynn Gehry coming at it from a slightly different angle. This is from episode 332.
How is it that a small group of people can intimidate, deceive, or stupefy a huge number of people into submitting to a social arrangement that actually prevents most of them from ever reaching their full stature as human beings? A person whose body is in bondage, but whose mind is free, can one day devise an escape. But a person whose mind is in bondage, who cannot even dream of freedom, will never be other than a slave. And that is why the shaping of our minds is of such interest to me and a primary component of the material presented to you on this program. Last week, in our ongoing reading of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, we began Chapter 7, The Prussian Connection, wherein Gatto explained how the structure and purposes of American compulsory schooling were modeled after the schools of Prussia, which was the seminal modern totalitarian state, a state in which the citizen cedes all rights in return for basic security, a state where, at the time of the American Revolution, Prussian women were required to report monthly to the police on the onset of menses. If Germans would submit to such a state in the 18th and 19th century, it is not so surprising that they would submit to a similar state in the 20th. But Gatto is talking about the Prussians because 19th century American elites strove to emulate Prussian society by recreating their school system here. Last week's reading contained a description of the three levels of schooling in Prussia. The top level were private schools for the elites, the only schools that gave a real education fit for human beings, teaching people to think, to plan, to argue, to understand history, to envision society's course. The next level, the top state schools, were to train professionals, technocrats, and the police, the ones that would realize the social visions of the elite group. The largest group of Prussian youth attended what were called the people's schools, where they were filled with propagandized history and conditioned to obedience. Gatto wrote, quote, "Prussian schools delivered everything they promised. Every important matter could now be confidently worked out in advance by leading families and institutional heads, because well-schooled masses would concur with a minimum of opposition," close quote. What is emerging as one reads Gatto's book is, I think, an important understanding about the people who pushed through the American education system. Obviously, there had to be a consensus, at least on some level. And the proponents of this system believed themselves to be acting in the best interest of society. These educational reformers were quite upfront about their desire to manage and mold the working class. Underlying their zeal was an ugly and elitist premise that is very much alive and well today, that the people slated to a life of drudgery are fit for no better. After all, if you are a person with a conscience, how do you doom another person to standing on an assembly line from morning to evening, making repetitive motions, robbed of creative satisfaction and control of even the minutes and hours of one's life? Sitting when you want to sit, standing when you want to stand. But in order for a few people to get very rich and live lives very different from this, large numbers of people must be persuaded to submit mentally as well as physically to such a life. How does one justify this if one is a moral person in a nation that gives lip service to liberty and equality? By claiming that this is all that some people are fit for and that they are happy doing that.
We are going to get back to forced schooling in the US, a very important factor in the development of the deep state, conditioning people to obedience and seeding their understanding with some misleading narratives. First, a little bit of background as presented in episode 614.
The charter for the First National Bank of the United States was due to run out in 1812. Congress refused to renew the charter. Almost immediately, war between America and Britain broke out. Many causes are given for the War of 1812, but anger over the elimination of the First National Bank, which British bankers held a major stake in, is never mentioned. The two richest men in America at the time were Stephen Girard and John Jacob Astor. The Astor family is best known for its real estate, but John Jacob made his fortune first in fur trading and opium. In current U.S. dollars, these men would have been twice as wealthy as Bill Gates. Girard and Astor both held large shares in Hamilton's First National Bank of the U.S., and after it was shut down, the two men used their influence to promote Alexander Dallas to the post of Treasury Secretary. Dallas used his position to push through a new central bank, which Girard and Astor would be major stockholders in as well. The Second National Bank of the U.S. would not last any longer than the first, however, for in the election of 1828, war hero Andrew Jackson ran on an anti-bank platform and won. As president, addressing a delegation of bankers, he famously said, "You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to rout you out, and by the grace of the eternal God, I will rout you out." When Congress approved a bill to recharter the bank in 1832, Jackson vetoed it.
225.
Both parties right now are anchored in what I call a corporate regime, by which I mean a system of power which takes more or less the form of a constitutional democracy with elections and the electoral procedures that we think about as related to democracy, but is actually, to be crude, a pseudo-democracy where the voting and the elections are producing outcomes that are pretty much determined by the large transnational companies that are the fundamental institutional foundations of the regime. And what I try to do in the book is trace American history since the Civil War and show that this isn't the first time that we've been governed by a corporate regime. There was one right after the Civil War during the Gilded Age, the Rockefeller-Morgan period, the first real period in American history when modern corporations came into being, gained great influence in America, took over much of Washington, and set the agenda for the country, creating enormous inequality and vast corruption of American political life 100 years ago. It happened again, what I call the second corporate regime, during the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, another period of enormous business domination of America. This was a period when what I call the second corporate regime introduced the religion of mass consumerism and where there was an ideology developed that's, you know, sort of reached into the present day. What characterizes a corporate regime is a domination of the country and of both political parties by corporate interests that are pretty much married to the political classes. There, what happens in a corporate regime is that the distinction between the economic elites and the political classes erode. And you get a kind of unholy alliance between the leaders of the transnational companies and the political elites, people like Bush, Cheney, and even Clinton, who represents a different sector of these elites, these corporate elites. The first corporate regime, which rose up after the Civil War, came into being because of the Civil War, really. The Civil War created a powerful federal state. It's interesting that the roots of corporations are always closely tied to war.
222.
The fatal problem was evident to Abraham Lincoln over a century ago. And this is not much quoted. Lincoln warned in a private letter, quote, "As a result of the war, corporations have been enthroned by the war, as usual, and an era of corruption in high places will follow. And the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed." Unquote. That's Lincoln. Lincoln was assassinated within a few months, 5 months of that letter, to a colonel. U.S. corporate rule has since been instituted across the world and now, triumphalist over all alternatives, invades across the world wherever there is room for, quote, more freedom and development for its money sequencing operations. Whether the civil common sectors and unpriced life spaces within existing capitalist societies or the entire economy and resource stocks of non-capitalist societies which are defenseless against attack.
The roots of corporations are always closely tied to war. And the first robber barons, people like Jay Gould and other railroad barons, had got their money out of war profiteering during the Civil War, running guns and charging on both sides a lot of money to the governments, both the South and the North, generating funds.
422.
The real push for what were then known as common schools in America comes during the 1840s. You might think they were very tolerant. They wanted to educate the poor kids. They knew the private school systems were doing a reasonably good job of making kids literate. That was not the subject. This business you hear today about the school system needed to educate poor kids, those are all after-the-fact sort of rationalizations. Those were not the arguments used at that time. The arguments used at that time had to do with the problem of social diversity, the problems of social conflict, which were caused by the mass influx at first of the Irish immigrants, who had the double sin of being at once Irish and at once Catholic, It was bad to be Irish because, remember, these guys are New England Whig types, and they're very pro-English. You can imagine the effect if you're a poor Irish family, you come over, save your pennies, get over to Boston, find that your child is required to attend a so-called common school, which at that time was a Protestant school. They read from the Protestant Bible. They read Protestant histories. You send your little kid off to the Protestant school, and what does he learn? He learns throughout his text that the Pope is the Antichrist, a phrase that constantly recurs throughout the textbooks of the time. He learns how wonderful Oliver Cromwell was, the man who killed and massacred thousands of your ancestors. He learns that the Irish were a barbaric race. He learns all these things, and you're not too thrilled about this. So what do? You start setting up your own parochial school system, because you're not going to have your children taught these Protestant, virulently anti-Catholic values. Well, the Protestants weren't going to put up with this either. They wanted these kids forced into these schools, and they said so. Consider this very typical passage from a very important educational journal from 1850 called The Massachusetts Teacher. Referring to the problem of Irish and Catholic immigration, by the way, the term that was used oftentimes, we must Americanize the immigrants. Or they also used the term, we must Christianize the Catholics. Here's one of the typical passages from the literature of this time from Massachusetts. And we're talking about Irish Catholics. With the old, not much can be done. But with their children, the great remedy is education. The rising generation must be taught as our children are taught. We say must be because in many cases this can only be accomplished by coercion. Now, no, you don't have to read between the lines here, right? This is why I read this directly. If I said it was this blunt, you probably wouldn't believe me. Say, no one would be stupid enough to put it that clearly. In too many instances, the parents, again, Irish Catholic parents, are unfit guardians of their own children. If left to their direction, the young will be brought up in idle, dissolute, vagrant habits, which will make them worse members of society than their parents are. Instead of filling our public schools, they will find their way into our prisons, houses of correction, and almshouses. Nothing can operate effectually here but stringent legislation thoroughly carried out by an efficient police. The children must be gathered up and forced into school. And those who resist or impede this plan, whether parents or priests, with priests italicized, must be held accountable and punished. Close quote.
520.
Prussia pulled it off by marching the kids to school at Bannock Point, and as a consequence, turning lives into human resources. And a leader then can focus the human resources, confident that there'll be no contradictions. That works with a factory economy. Does not work to give the majority of people good lives, but it does work to build wealth and to give great wealth to the leadership, the management.
So the education is oriented towards the interests of the state, not towards the interest of the individual
student.
The interests
of the state and also the interests of the dominant economy, making it more efficient. When Prussian schooling came to the United States big time, it was brought here by Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, Harriman. I mean, they front some poor chump named Horace Mann, who loved the Prussians, just loved them. But in fact, Mann was a politician who had no interest whatsoever in children or schooling. He was promised a seat in the American Congress if he could pull off forced schooling, and he did.
225.
In that period, right following the Civil War, you had 11 presidents up to Teddy Roosevelt, all of whom were sort of Bush-like presidents. They were corporate presidents. The only Democrat of the lot, a man very much like Bill Clinton, was a guy named Grover Cleveland, who served twice, and his inaugural statement said, the first thing he said was, big business has nothing to fear if I come into power. He also said at the point when, at the famous Homestead strike, a steel strike in 1894, when strikers pleaded with him to aid their cause because they were being killed by some company goons, he said, you might as well ask me to dissolve the government of the United States, that is to help come in and help, you know, side by the workers.
19.
The masters of the government of the United States are the combined capitalists and manufacturers of the United States. That was former President Woodrow Wilson I was quoting, who said that in 1907. He didn't talk like that after he became president.
So it was pretty clear at that point that even the one Democratic president during this period had been absorbed within what I call that first corporate regime, which was dominated by Rockefeller and Morgan and people like that. You said, did it happen by accident? What was occurring was that you were seeing new technology development. The sort of internet of the day was the railroads, and they were bringing the market together. Before the Civil War, corporations had been local and regional entities. There had been no real national corporations. So the railroads helped create the infrastructure for a national corporation, just as the internet today has helped create the infrastructure technologically for a global corporation, which is the key entity of the current regime. In every regime, the constitution changes. One of the interesting aspects of a regime is that it creates very fundamental changes in the constitutional structure of the country. A Yale Law School guy named Bruce Ackerman has written that the United States has not had one constitution. It's had four or five constitutions. And each of these correspond roughly to the regimes I'm talking about. And during the Gilded Age, these Bush-like Republican presidents appointed Supreme Court justices who used the 14th Amendment, which was the amendment passed after the Civil War, presumably to protect freed slaves and protecting their resubjugation. It said that every citizen was entitled to due process under the law and that you could not treat citizens unequally. It turns out that this constitutional amendment became the fundamental foundation for vesting corporations with legal rights as persons. A lot of people now know of the corporate personhood concept, which was a concept that developed during this first corporate regime when in a Supreme Court decision known as the Santa Clara Act of 1886, that came to be interpreted by later courts as for the first time affirming that corporations were legal entities that should be have constitutional protections, First Amendment rights, speech rights, which included the rights to give money to political campaigns.
141.
Finally, in 1886, the story goes that you'll hear in law school and that most people believe, and you'll find in a lot of books, corporations were given the rights of persons. The Supreme Court ruled that they were persons, that the 14th Amendment, because it failed to say natural persons, had to include corporations as well. I wanted to read the decision, you know, because I'd read so much about it. So I walked into the Supreme Court building, and the guy who runs the library there, Paul Donovan, I said, Paul, I'm looking for this 1886 ruling. And so he takes me back into this old dusty stack of books, and he says, here's the original book published in 1889, you know, the U.S. reports, and this old creaky, cracky, you know, kind of falling apart thing. At the end of the decision, the court points out that there were a series of arguments made before the court, including the argument that corporations are persons, and that the court chose not to rule on any of these constitutional issues. So I'm reading the decision, and the decision says, this court never ruled that corporations are persons. So I went to Paul, and I said, Paul, I'm missing something here, because I've been hearing, you know, and for 120 years, you know, it's a... And Paul says, well, you know, I'm not a lawyer. He says, but look at this part of it. And there's this little fine print at the front of the page before the decision. And the first sentence of the fine print says, corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection under the law. And I said, what's that? And he said, that's the head note. He said, that wasn't written by the Supreme Court. That was written by the reporter of the court, who was an employee of the banks, and Biddle, I think, was the company, the publishing company in New York that publishes the book. And it's just, you know, a commentary. And I said, does it have the force of law? And he said, I don't think so, but you need to talk to the lawyer. So I made the copies of the thing, went around the corner to the office, walked down the street and around the corner to the office of Jim Ridfoe, who's an old friend of mine, who's a lawyer, you know, went to law school, said, you know, Jim, you know about the 1886 case? And he, oh, yeah, that's when corporations became persons. And I said, well, here's the case. And I laid it down on his desk, you know, and I had highlighted these parts. I said, read it. And he's reading it, and he goes, well, this isn't what we learned in school. And I said, now look at the head note. And he reads the head note, and he goes, holy cow. Well, he was a little more expletive than that. And I said, what happened? And he said, well, this thing says clearly corporations are not persons, but the head note says that they are. And he says, the head note's wrong. And I said, well, you know, how'd that happen? And he said, well, there's mistakes in law books all the time. He said, one of the first things they train lawyers in law school is not to read head notes because, you know, that's just a commentary. It's not legal. And I said, but, you know, 120 years of American law have been based on this. You know, I was starting to sound hysterical, you know. And Jim is like, well, you know, these mistakes happen. He said, but you need to talk to somebody who really knows constitutional law. So I got on the phone and I called up the Secretary of State in Vermont, told her the story of it, and she said, well, you know, she said, head notes don't have precedent. They are not law. There was a 1905 Supreme Court case, in fact, in which the Supreme Court ruled that headnotes don't have precedent. So the whole idea that corporations should be entitled to human rights, which is the important next step in our conversation, I think, turns out it was a lie. The whole thing, it was a theft. That's why I say the theft of human rights. Corporations stole human rights by co-opting the court reporter. Turns out the court reporter was a former president of a railroad, and he just wrote that in.
That is incredible. So, but it begs the question then of, so is everything that followed that then debatable now? I mean, can we fix it?
Well, yes and no. What happened was that there were several cases that followed this in the 1890s that referenced the headnotes in the 1886 case, but then continued to say the corporations are persons, therefore they should have rights to free speech, they should have rights to privacy, they should have rights to not have to self-incriminate, they should have rights to against discrimination. And once the Supreme Court, even though the basis of its ruling was wrong, once it ruled that this was the case, then that actually became the precedent. So it is the law of the land that corporations are persons, even though it's based on a lie, and the Supreme Court has never, ever had an argument about this before it in which it made a decision.
The first corporate regime produced a system that is very familiar today, a system of great gaps between the rich and the poor. In 1890, 90% of Americans were poor. Rockefeller became the country's first billionaire. You had a lot of breaking of labor unions that were beginning to form then. You had significant economic growth, as you had in the 1990s here, but the overwhelming majority of the growth was being creamed off by the top 1% of the population. What the first corporate regime showed was that ultimately these regimes are not capable of sustaining themselves, and they generate mass popular movements against their power.
A useful historical parallel there in our present situation helps us perhaps to understand things such as the Occupy movement or the Yellow Jackets. Now let's return to episode 422.
How is this new individual, what he calls corporate individualism, how is it to be implemented? Well, he says, look, science has mastered technology. Science has mastered nature. And now science must master society. We need to apply the same kind of social engineering and expert technology to society that we've previously applied to the physical sciences. In short, Dewey's model of a society, summing up the whole corporate view, is a society planned by social experts employing the scientific method. Now, remember what I said about war and their fascination with war and how, the kind of corporate society that war created. Concerning World War I, he said, war has revealed the possibilities of intelligent administration. How so? Because of the central planning and nationalization of industry and business. Now, remember I said that this is not just sort of a scientific planning mentality, it's also the evangelical zeal mentality. He says, there's only one way out of the existing educational confusion and drift. That way is a definite substitution of a social purpose, controlling methods of teaching and discipline, and materials for study for the traditional individualistic aim. He went on in a thing called My Pedagogic Creed to say, now here's where the evangelical pietism comes in, I believe that the teacher is engaged not simply in the training of individuals, but in the formation of proper social life. Every teacher should realize the dignity of his calling, that he is a social servant sent apart for the maintenance of proper social order and the securing of the right social growth. The teacher is always the prophet of the true God and the usher in of the true kingdom of God. Now, Dewey is virtually an atheist or an agnostic. Just like man was a Unitarian, but note the Calvinistic language, the evangelical language. The teacher is the prophet of the true God and the usher in of the true kingdom of God. What is the true God and the true kingdom of God? Well, the true God is some kind of common good, corporate good. The true kingdom of God is this planned, rigorously enforced social order or corporate order as Dewey envisioned it.
539.
If you want to know the motives of this project, you need only read the first public mission statement of Rockefeller's General Education Board that was printed in its first report to well-wishers issued in 1906. And I'm going to read you the first paragraph. In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present education conventions of intellectual and character education fade from their minds, and unhampered by tradition, We work our own will upon a grateful and responsive folk. Can you believe people actually wrote this and printed it? We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or men of science. We have not to raise up from them authors, educators, poets, men of letters. We shall not search for artists, painters, musicians, lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of which we have an ample supply. The task is simple. We will organize children and teach them in a perfect way the things their fathers and mothers are doing in an imperfect way. The real purpose of modern schooling was announced by Edward Ross of the University of Wisconsin in the same year that was written. Ross is generally considered one of the three founders of the 20th century discipline called sociology. And in a book bluntly called Social Control, Ross wrote, I'll quote directly, "Plans are underway to replace family, church, and community with propaganda, education," he meant schooling, "and mass media. People," he informed his readers, "are only little plastic lumps of dough."
368.
The theory of democratic elites provided a way for plutocracy to hide inside the skin of democracy. To have ordinary people represented by the best, selected by the best. Here was Orwellian newspeak of a very high order. Since the commons could not be trusted to select the best from amongst itself, the community of quality would have to do it for them, backstage, concealing, in the interests of social efficiency but also from humane motives, the full reality of the radical political transformation. America was whisked off stage and replaced by a political impostor, anglicized in its attitudes.
315.
What fascinated and frightened them was the picture Freud painted of submerged, dangerous forces lurking just under the surface of modern society. Forces that could erupt easily to produce the frenzied mob which had the power to destroy even governments. It was this they believed had happened in Russia. To many, this meant that one of the guiding principles of mass democracy was wrong. The belief that human beings could be trusted to make decisions on a rational basis. The leading political writer, Walter Lippmann, argued that if human beings were in reality driven by unconscious, irrational forces, then it was necessary to rethink democracy. What was needed was a new elite who could manage what he called the bewildered herd. This would be done through psychological techniques that would control the unconscious feelings of the masses.
586.
Manufacturing consent. What is that title meant to describe?
Well, the title is actually borrowed from a book by Walter Lippmann, written back around 1921, in which he described what he called the manufacture of consent as a revolution in the practice of democracy. What it amounts to is a technique of control. And he said this was useful and necessary because the common interests, the general concerns of all people, elude the public. The public just isn't up to dealing with them. And they have to be the domain of what he called a specialized class. Notice that that's the opposite of the standard view about democracy.
So, in the modern parlance, that would be called a conspiracy theory. We return to 368.
Lippmann produced his own pair of influential books, Public Opinion, 1922, followed by The Phantom Public in 1925. Public Opinion called for severe restrictions on public debate. The historic American argument was a defect of democracy, quote unquote. It was impossible, said Lippmann, for the public even to know what its own best interests were. The public was hopelessly childish. It had to be cared for. Schools would have to teach children that the old ideal of active participatory citizenship was biologically impossible. Decisions in complex industrial society had to be made by, quote, invisible experts acting through government officials, close quote, for the good of all. The proper thing to do, said Lippmann, was to give the public a fairy tale explanation, something to sustain it emotionally, as we tell a bedtime story to infants. Later, as he saw the effects of his advice unfold, Lippmann would repudiate them, but that's another story. The common public would have to be neutralized in the name of democracy for this expert society, this new republic based on sciences of human behavior to work. In the state institution of forced schooling, it would be better in the long run if children learned little or nothing in the short run. America was coming full circle to its British Germanic and Episcopal beginnings.
And that was from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Now let's continue with a quick summary from the man himself from episode 745.
As bizarre as I know it sounds, under corporate capitalism and corporate governance, ways must be found to make the general public less productive and less self-reliant. And school is the mechanism to do that.
Now let's hear from Smithy, an anonymous financial whistleblower whose program, Wizards of Money, was actually the means whereby I first discovered Unwelcome Guests and RadioForAll.net. This is from the most popular episode of that series, Wizards and Warlords, which was part of Unwelcome Guests episode number 75.
According to a lawyer named Alfred Crozier, who gave testimony before a Senate Banking Committee around the time the Federal Reserve System was being readied for implementation, President Garfield had stated shortly before his assassination, quote, whoever controls the supply of currency would control the business activities of all the people, end quote. He also reminded the committee that Thomas Jefferson had warned 100 years earlier that, quote, a private central bank issuing the public currency was a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army, end quote. So Jefferson attributed more danger to the wizards of an empire than to its warlords, which is very interesting. This may be because the wizard's power of control is psychological, not physical, and so can go largely unnoticed and therefore continue unchecked. But the power exercised by warlords is obvious and therefore more likely to be challenged. Hence it is in the interest of any empire to replace physically forced rule by warlords by the psychological rule of wizardry in lands where it has become practical to do so. After the embarrassment of the public's representative taking over wizardry during the Civil War, the bankers were very busy re-establishing their powers.
614.
In 1910, seven men got on a train headed for Jekyll Island, Georgia, ostensibly to do some duck hunting. Nelson Aldrich was among them, as was Paul Warburg, and representatives of the Rockefeller and Morgan banking interests. Also there was Abram Andrews, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. The men took precautions to ensure complete secrecy and referred to each other only by their first names. Over the next 10 days, they hammered out the details of what would become the Federal Reserve System. The proposal was originally introduced in Congress as the Aldrich Plan, but was shot down. Paul Warburg rewrote it under the name the Federal Reserve Act, which Senator Aldrich publicly opposed to try and fool the other congressmen. The two bills were essentially the same. Lest we forget who was ultimately behind this, an agent of Brown Brothers, Colonel Elisha Garrison, wrote in his 1931 book, Roosevelt, Wilson, and the Federal Reserve Law. Paul Warburg is the man who got the Federal Reserve Act together after the Aldrich Plan aroused such nationwide resentment and opposition. The mastermind of both plans was Baron Alfred Rothschild of London. The Act passed the House and Senate in late December of 1913, and the differences were hammered out while most congressmen were out of town for the holidays. It is debatable whether Woodrow Wilson, who signed the bill the next day, fully understood the nature of what he was a party to, or if he was simply a puppet.
And it's a simple but an important point in the study of deep politics, because there's so much in the way of smoke and mirrors. Who knows ultimately who was tricked and who was a willing party to deception? So one of the lessons that I've learnt in compiling this encyclopedia of deep politics is to try and suspend my natural tendency to make judgments about good and bad, right and wrong, who's telling the truth and who's lying, and really focus on the evidence that we have, who said what, when, and leave interpretation up to the readers. Now we continue with episode 530. This is part of a radio adaptation of Scott Noble's film Human Resources.
Between 1922 and 1929, an arm of the Rockefeller Foundation gave out almost $50 million toward the pursuit of the social sciences around the world. According to historian Judith C. Lander, the spur was a need for better organization in society at large. What had begun as a public relations ploy to assuage public anger in the face of unscrupulous business practices and violent suppression of working people, the Rockefeller charities would set out to change society as a whole.
242.
Large parts of the corporate elite despised what Roosevelt's New Deal stood for. And so, in 1934, a group of conspirators sought to involve General Butler in a treasonous plan.
The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club at least, to intimidate the government.
But the corporate cabal had picked the wrong man. Butler was fed up with being what he called a gangster for capitalism.
229.
Well, I talked to Speaker of the House McCormick, who was at the time, he was the head of the McCormick-Dickstein Committee, which was investigating the situation. And after his investigation of all the allegations, he said that this was a plot to turn America fascist, and actually it would have succeeded except for the fact that the plotters chose the wrong man to lead the revolution, somebody they thought they could con and control. It was the Pews, the DuPonts, I'm trying to recall now, the General Motors, and Remington Arms was involved, and the arms manufacturers and the chemical companies were providing the arms for the paramilitary army, and the others were providing money and prestige. They organized together in something called the Liberty League, which was supposedly to protect the Constitution, and this was the mask they were going to use for their whole project. And they intended to say that Roosevelt, who everybody knew was stricken with polio, was too ill to rule a country, and therefore they were going to give him an assistant president, who of course would be the dictator.
And this is from last episode, 749.
In the McCormack-Dickstein report, a shipping company called Hamburg America Line was accused of providing free passage to Germany to American journalists willing to write favourable copy on Hitler's rise to power. The company is also alleged to have brought Nazi spies and pro-fascist sympathizers into America. John Buchanan has studied this later section of the report and has discovered that one of the company's managers came from a very famous family.
The thing that surprised me most was to discover in the documents that this company, Hamburg America Lines, had in fact been managed on the U.S. side at the executive level by Prescott Bush, as part of a web of Nazi business interests that were all seized in late 1942 under the Trading with the Enemy Act by the U.S. Congress. And Prescott Bush is the grandfather of the sitting president of the United States.
At that time, our friend Mr. Paul Warburg, who we met in Wizards Part 1, and who had been responsible for much of the design of the Federal Reserve System and was certainly one of the 20th century's most amazing wizards, was a governor of the Federal Reserve Board. Another powerful banker of the times was a Mr. Eugene Meyer, who was chairman of the War Finance Corporation, which, according to the New York Times, August 10th, 1918 edition, had been planned by Mr. Warburg himself. These two chaps exercised tremendous power and influence over the financing of war at the time and made sure that the bankers were able to profit from the financing of war. Interestingly, Mr. Warburg's brother, Max Warburg, was the head of the German Secret Service at the time. There is no doubt that the Warburg brothers not only represented a powerful wizard-warlord alliance in a single set of siblings, but they were clearly operating on both sides of the war. And for this, they profited doubly.
581.
The big American corporations, many of them were on both sides of the Second World War. Ford was an early fan of and promoter of and supporter of Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler had his picture up in his Munich office. How did the Third Reich develop the machinery, the financial know-how, the wherewithal to become such an engine of conquest? And it was U.S. companies, Ford Company, then General Motors with Opel, then IBM. Of course, people will have read Edwin Black's IBM and the Holocaust. These U.S. corporations played, you know, both sides of the street, as it were. And in a way, they were much more pleased with the German approach to capitalism than Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal.
614.
German banker Mayer Amschel Rothschild and his sons were quickly becoming a banking powerhouse across Europe and England. His eldest son Amschel in Frankfurt, Solomon in Vienna, Nathan in London, Carl in Naples, and James in Paris. Frederick Morton writes, "The history of the House of Rothschild has been to an amazing degree the backstage history of Western Europe, because of their success in making loans not to individuals, but to nations." Napoleon was terrorizing Europe at the time, and Nathan and James, by far the most successful of the Rothschild sons, reaped huge profits by financing both sides of the war.
Now, this is the part from episode 577, which inspired my presentation, A Brief History of Plutocracy.
The Rothschild formula. 1. War is the ultimate discipline to any government. If it can successfully meet the challenge of war, it will survive. If it cannot, it will perish. All else is secondary. The prosperity of its citizens and the solvency of its treasury will be quickly sacrificed by any government in its primal act of self-survival. 2. All that is necessary, therefore, to ensure that a government will maintain or expand its debt is to involve it in war, or the threat of war. The greater the threat, and the more destructive the war, the greater the need for debt. 3. To involve a country in war, or the threat of war, it will be necessary for it to have enemies with credible military might. Now, if such enemies already exist, all the better. If they exist but lack military strength, it will be necessary to provide them the money to build their war machine. If an enemy does not exist at all, then it will be necessary to create one by financing the rise of a hostile, warlike regime. 4. The ultimate obstacle is a government which refuses to finance its wars through the mandrake mechanism. Although this seldom happens, when it does, it will be necessary to encourage political opposition, insurrection, or revolution to replace that government from the inside with one that will. The assassination of heads of state will play an important role in this process. 5. No nation can be allowed to remain militarily stronger than its adversaries, for that could lead to peace and a reduction of debt. To accomplish this balance of power, it may be necessary to finance both sides of the conflict. Wherever possible, neither side should be allowed a decisive victory or defeat. The objective is perpetual war. Now, I believe that says it all. And any protege of mine in the cabal who didn't understand that would soon be on the outside. It's very clear. And I think that if you hold that formula in mind, at least as a possibility, take a look at history, the meaning of history suddenly becomes quite different than it had before.
Now we return once more to Smithy from Unwelcome Guests episode 75.
While Paul Warburg was a governor of the Federal Reserve Board of the United States, the Warburg family was financing the Kaiser in Germany. They also helped finance the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Mr. Mullins, in his book Secrets of the Federal Reserve, cites some text from a December 12, 1918 U.S. Naval Secret Service report that says that Paul Warburg, quote, handled large sums furnished by Germany for Lenin and Trotsky.
675.
I published in one of my books a copy of a cablegram which transferred funds from New York to Petrograd in December 1917, $1 million to be precise. And Colonel Thompson made the statement later that this $1 million was given to the Bolsheviks.
Paul Warburg, quote, handled large sums furnished by Germany for Lenin and Trotsky, and also has a brother who is leader of the espionage system of Germany, end quote. In fact, it is not unusual to see bankers operate on both sides of a war.
581.
The capitalist class, of course, saw in Hitler a bastion of defense against the expansion of Soviet-style communism. So coming out of the Second World War, these companies had experiences on both sides. Standard Oil, the Rockefeller Company, was a big part of IG Farben. IG Farben started a place called Auschwitz, which began as a factory for producing airplane fuel from coal. You know, it was a privatized effort. After World War II, of course, the United States had all the gold. Its industry was intact. Europe was decimated. Japan was decimated. And it was a moment of great power for the United States. And the permanent war economy that had begun in 1941 after the invasion of Pearl Harbor, the decision was made to simply continue it and to subsidize the big companies through the military-industrial complex. Some have called this military Keynesianism. The CIA was created in 1947 with the National Security Act, and this act had as its basis the idea that the Soviet Union, which had been an ally during the Second World War, would no longer be an ally.
It is not unusual to see bankers operate on both sides of a war. After all, it is not their job to be concerned with this ideology or that, but simply to keep the medium of exchange flowing and to make a profit for shareholders. Plus, being on all sides of a conflict will enable them to quickly fit into the appropriate wizard role within the victorious empire. Mullins also points out in his book that Woodrow Wilson did not really believe in his own crusade to save the world for democracy by getting America involved in World War I, because Wilson had written much later that, quote, the World War was a matter of economic rivalry, end quote. Interestingly, it was this World War that really saw the development of the income tax system and the role of the Federal Reserve, operated by the bankers, as fiscal agents of the government. Since then, America has used the income tax system and debt money issuance as the primary way of financing wars from which both bankers and many other corporations would profit. The Romans also similarly taxed their citizens in all of their provinces as a primary means of financing their conquests. The Warburg brothers were the most outstanding example of a warlord-wizard relationship within a single set of siblings operating on both sides of the First World War. They passed this baton onto a new set of brothers to take on this role for the Second World War, the Dulles brothers.
659.
Nearly all of the senior directors and deputy directors of the CIA were recruited from Wall Street, and not only from Wall Street, but from that part of Wall Street who figured also in the New York Social Register, that is to say, who were a wealthy, affluent part of the ruling establishment that prevails in Manhattan. The deep state is all the ways that those people have influence over American policy. Now, the CIA in the early days was like their special plaything, and when something inside CIA was created called OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination, very innocuous title, very insidious agency which started planning coups and assassinations all around the world.
739.
The Dulles era is the beginning of everything that we're grappling with today. Every president virtually that the Dulles brothers served, particularly Alan Dulles, the presidencies were subverted, I would go as far as to say, by the Alan Dulles. All the kind of controversial policies from torture, extraordinary rendition, extralegal assassination, subversion of foreign governments, even foreign allies, massive surveillance of private citizens, on and on down the list, all these things that we associate with the post-9/11 era actually have their origins in the Dulles era.
641.
John Foster Dulles, brother of CIA Director Alan Dulles, proclaimed after World War II that, in order to make the country bear the burden, we have to create an emotional atmosphere akin to wartime psychology. We must create the idea of a threat from without. Senator Arthur Vandenberg was more blunt. In 1947, he advised President Truman to, quote, scare the hell out of the American people. And that's exactly what they proceeded to do.
There's a succinct and pointed quote from General Douglas MacArthur. Our country is now geared to an arms economy, which was bred in an artificially induced psychosis of war hysteria and nurtured upon an incessant propaganda of fear. 739.
These companies were interlinked. They would have subsidiaries, German and American companies, that were connected. And so at one point it got so absurd that in hiding these assets, they were protecting these companies, and the technology that America needed to pursue the war, diesel technology, fuel technology, and products were being kept from the U.S. military. So you could say, I mean, that was a direct subversion of the war effort that was being undertaken by corporate clients of the Dulles brothers. That's why people like Goldberg later thought they should have been put on trial for treason. Clearly, they put the interests of their clients, even when they were Nazi-related or Nazis, above the good of the country and the war effort.
The unspeakable.
George F. Kennan, who helped create the CIA.
We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task is to devise a pattern of relationship which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity. Without detriment to our national security, we should cease to talk about unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of the living standard, and democratization. We are going to have to deal in straight power concept.
With National Security Council Directive 10/2 in 1947, the CIA was set up to do
propaganda, economic warfare, sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition, subversion against hostile states, assistance to underground movements, guerrillas, and refugee liberation groups.
Fletcher Prouty was an Air Force colonel assigned to set up the Office of Special Operations in the Pentagon to provide military logistical support for the CIA's covert operations. Alan Dulles told Prouty,
I want a focal point, an office that's clear to do what has to be done.
We had to have contact points in the State Department, in the Treasury, in the FBI, and all through the government, up to the White House.
Jim Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable.
The focal point's office constituted a powerful, unseen force, unseen government within the government.
Richard Helms, covert operations chief, CIA.
When you establish a clandestine service like the Central Intelligence Agency, you establish something that was totally different from anything else in the United States government.
And this new covert operations office had, from its beginnings, corporate partners. President Eisenhower, 3 days before John F. Kennedy was inaugurated.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
Within the government, there exists what some have called the national security state. It's not a formal organization as such. It consists of the president, the secretaries of state and defense, the National Security Council, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and numerous intelligence agencies. By the way, it consists of those if they're operating in the right class and power direction. When Kennedy was making noises and was toying with a soft policy toward Cuba, it's very interesting. Robert Murrow wrote about this in his book, First Hand Knowledge. Robert Murrow was a Republican, right-wing businessman who wrote a book, told how he was a CIA operative, and was in on the Kennedy assassination. He got the Manlinka Carbona guns and actually gave them out and didn't know what he was doing. Later on, he realized the role he had played and was very surprised how the CIA was in operation with mafia elements and all that. It was kind of unsettling for this nice, you know, white Protestant Republican guy to find this out about the CIA. And what's interesting is that when the CIA had troubles with Kennedy, then Kennedy was no longer quite in that inner circle. They actually withheld information from the president. So those agencies, those operations of state will withhold information even from other elements within the national security state if they begin to find them unreliable. And when Kennedy appointed McCone, got rid of Dulles, they withheld information from the director of the CIA himself. So it really depends on which political ideological direction you go in. These things are very flexible and very operational in a way. The national security state often operates like an unaccountable sovereign power of its own. None of these people said, not once, read this whole book, not once does he quote anybody getting up and saying, the Constitution says the president is endowed with sovereign power because he's elected by the people, so maybe we should tell him this. Not, I mean, anybody who said that, he'd probably end up, dying of natural causes. The primary function of the national security state is to defeat anti-capitalist forces at home and abroad, or movements that try to introduce any economically redistributive politics, even within the existing capitalist framework, in any kind of fundamental reformist way. Making the world safe for free market capitalism is a massive enterprise. Security agencies expend about $40 to $50 billion a year on operations at home and abroad, probably more. Congress has no exact idea how much it is because it's hidden in the Pentagon budget and other places. The total figure is a secret, which is, by the way, in violation of the U.S. Constitution, which says that all receipts and expenditures and appropriations must be public knowledge.
In the 1950s, Guatemala's elected president, Jacobo Arbenz, wanted to do agrarian reform and decrease foreign companies' influence, including the United Fruit Company, a big American corporation.
Alan Dulles and his brother, Eisenhower's Secretary of State, both had financial interests in United Fruit Company's operations. They urged the U.S. government to depose Arbenz. E. Howard Hunt, the head of the CIA's anti-Arbenz mission.
What we wanted to do was have a terror campaign to terrify Arbenz and terrify his troops, much as the German Stuka bombers terrified the population of Holland, Belgium, and Poland at the onset of World War II.
The CIA and its public relations people talked about a Soviet beachhead in the Western Hemisphere, not about the fact that the United Fruit Company wanted to keep its resources and power in Guatemala. Arbenz was ousted in a CIA-supported coup in 1954.
But the CIA and the military, Kennedy too, they were all fighting communism, right? They wanted to keep America safe.
Safe? Here's a partial list of what the CIA was up to.
Mohammad Mossadegh, Prime Minister of Iran, overthrown in 1953. Patrice Lumumba, Prime Minister of the Republic of Congo, assassinated in 1961.
General Rafael Trujillo, President of the Dominican Republic, assassinated in 1961. Ngo Dinh Diem, President of South Vietnam, assassinated in 1963. François Papadoc Duvalier, leader of Haiti, assassinated in 1971.
Charles de Gaulle, President of France, attempted assassination. And Che Guevara's execution.
And then there were the many attempts to oust and assassinate Fidel Castro.
In 1953, when President Eisenhower, Alan Dulles, and his brother, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, came into office, the country had 200 nuclear weapons. By 1961, we had 20,000.
581.
Big infusion of capital from the Defense Department has given the research and development arms of these companies huge government taxpayer subsidies. And those companies, of course, went on to dominate the world, dominate commercially, but also sort of culturally and politically. And in the name of the Cold War, in the name of anti-communism, these companies' interests were promoted by the military in a country, for instance, like Congo, which theoretically became self-governing in 1960. The first premier they chose was a man called Patrice Lumumba. He, like many of the other indigenous leaders of the time, wanted to nationalize the natural resources, which in Congo are hugely lucrative. This was not to be accepted. The idea that self-government would extend to the economy was not accepted by these global corporations. Patrice Lumumba was assassinated. We saw the same trajectory in Indonesia, you know, in many parts of the Western Hemisphere, in Chile, for instance, where Allende was removed. In the name of national security, the interests of U.S. corporations was made to prevail, primarily U.S. corporations, also some based in Europe, some based in Japan, the trilateral set there.
Now, with the background stated, the rise of corporate power in the U.S., the close connections between companies and war, we turn to episode 739 for our first look at a specific deep event.
50-some years on, it's pretty obvious at this point. What happened was that the CIA under Alan Dulles did build a killing team. It built an assassination kill team that was used all around the world. And that kill team, in one form or another, was brought back to Dallas to kill our own president.
Now, I'm just going to stop it there because he did use the phrase pretty obvious. And this program is directed at new listeners to the show. So you may be thinking, well, it isn't obvious to me. And I would encourage you to actually, with an open mind, take a look on the internet. You could just keep listening, of course, because we lay out some of the evidence, but it is increasingly clear that the lone nut story is a fiction. I, last month, for example, discovered two US servicemen who, as proved by documents released last year, independently, one in France, one in the UK, reported to their superiors that they thought Kennedy was about to be assassinated, and both of them were deemed mentally unstable, paranoid delusion, and were kept safely locked up until the assassination had taken place. So, in this instance, while it might be news to you, I think pretty obvious is not actually an overstatement of the case.
And it shouldn't be a surprise to people that, you know, when you create a beast like we did, this killing beast, and you put it in other people's backyards, that beast is going to enter your own home at some point, which is what it did in Dallas. So what happened was this. We now know that Howard Hunt, by his own admission, was involved in that crime. His son is convinced of it on his deathbed. He basically made a veiled confession. We now know that David Morales, another key assassin for the CIA, was also by his own admission in Dallas.
Whilst we could go down that road of looking at the individual killers, I'm mindful of Peter Dale Scott's comment that the bigger picture is more important than the individual circumstances. So, for the bigger picture, we return to episode 517, one of the most popular episodes that I've made. And we're going to hear quite a lot of it because the JFK assassination was such a seminal event in the genesis of the modern US deep state, and later the supranational deep state. And I haven't found anybody who can tell this story quite as clearly and compellingly as the speaker we're going to hear, Jim Douglas. His books present the political assassinations in the US of the 1960s not as isolated phenomena, but as separate facets of a single ongoing story. And he begins this section by speaking about the civil trial pertaining to the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I attended every session of that trial for 3 weeks and heard the 70 witnesses describe a plot against King that included CIA and FBI, Army Special Forces, sniper team, members of the Memphis Police, mafia intermediaries, and a man who was in the courtroom who had confessed to a role in the trial, a bar and grill owner named Lloyd Jowers. When the jury came back with their verdict, a jury of 6 black and 6 white citizens, they said that Dr. King had been assassinated indeed by a conspiracy that included, and they said this specifically, government agencies. There was a woman next to me in the courtroom who was from a reporter from a Lisbon daily journal. I guess it was the biggest newspaper in Lisbon, who had sent her to the U.S. to cover this trial. And she said to me at one point in the middle of the trial, "You know, Americans say that the O.J. Simpson trial is the trial of the century, and some others say that President Clinton's trial is the trial of the century." She said, "This is the trial of the century, and who's here? You, a writer of books, and me, a reporter from Portugal." And she looked around, and the courtroom was mostly empty, maybe a dozen other people there other than the participants. So that's another side of the question of the assassination of not only Martin Luther King, but also of Malcolm X, of John F. Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy, the four that I see really as one in terms of it being the same story told four times over, a story of turning, each of them turned in a deep sense toward justice and peace, each of them turned at great risk, and each of them suffered the same kinds of consequences. Tonight, I'm only talking about John Kennedy, but it's a story that continues after John Kennedy because of what went down in that one. That's the first of these four. After JFK, then in 65, there's Malcolm, then in 68, there are the other two, Martin and RFK. It's a journey into what Thomas Merton called the unspeakable. And that's why I think we need a spiritual guide. And the one that has helped me to go into the darkness of this question is Thomas Merton. I want to say a little bit about him first. As you know, he was the greatest spiritual writer perhaps of that time. And he saw its Cold War perils with a depth of insight that no one else seemed to have. From the Abbey of Gethsemane in the hills of Kentucky, Thomas Merton raised critical questions about President Kennedy that can help us see what was going on in Washington in the months leading up to Kennedy's assassination. In a letter Thomas Merton wrote to a friend in January 1962, 1 year into Kennedy's presidency, the monk summed up the president in a negative yet prophetic way. This is what he wrote. "I have little confidence in Kennedy. I think he cannot fully measure up to the magnitude of his task and lacks creative imagination and the deeper kind of sensitivity that is needed too much the time and life mentality, than which I can imagine nothing further in reality from, say, Lincoln. What is needed is really not shrewdness or craft, but what politicians don't have, depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. Maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination. As Thomas Merton observed, John F. Kennedy was no saint, nor was he initially up to his overwhelming task as president. He failed to stop the CIA's plan to invade the Bay of Pigs, and he began to be drawn into the Vietnam War. However, as Merton was praying for him to do, Kennedy was turning toward a deeper, more compassionate, more universal humanity. Shuva, turning, the biblical word for repentance, is the explanation for Kennedy's short-lived, contradictory journey toward peace. He was turning from what would have been the worst violence in history in the Cuban Missile Crisis toward a new, more peaceful humanity in his and our lives. Because he broke through by miracle to such a change, Kennedy was marked out for assassination. He had placed himself in deadly conflict with the unspeakable. The unspeakable is a term Thomas Merton coined at the heart of the 60s after JFK's assassination, in the midst of the escalating Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and the further assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. In each of those soul-shaking events, Merton sensed an evil whose depth and deceit seemed to go beyond the capacity of words to describe. One of the awful facts of our age, Merton wrote in 1965, is the evidence that the world is stricken indeed, stricken to the very core of its being by the presence of the unspeakable. Thomas Merton's sense of what John Kennedy needed to break through to, and the fatal consequences if he did so, call to mind a scene early in Kennedy's presidency. JFK had just met with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev in Vienna. Late at night, on the June 5, 1961 plane flight back to Washington, the weary president asked his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, if she would please file the documents he had been working on. As she started to clear the table in the plane, Evelyn Lincoln noticed a little slip of paper that had fallen on the floor. On it were two lines in Kennedy's handwriting, a favorite saying of his from Abraham Lincoln. I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. The summit meeting with Khrushchev had deeply disturbed Kennedy. The American president thought the Soviet chairman had shown no real concern about nuclear war and that he was unwilling to compromise, making nuclear war far more likely. Thus, Kennedy saw a storm coming. While reflecting that night on such a terrifying storm, Kennedy, echoing Lincoln, had written first to himself, I know there is a God. One summer weekend in 1962, while out sailing with friends, President Kennedy was asked what he thought of 7 Days in May, a best-selling novel that described a military takeover in the United States. JFK said he would read the book. He did so that night. The next day, Kennedy discussed with his friends the possibility of their seeing such a coup in the U.S. These words were spoken by him after the Bay of Pigs and before the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's possible for a military coup. It could happen in this country, but the conditions would have to be just right. If, for example, the country had a young president and he had a Bay of Pigs, there would be a certain uneasiness. Maybe the military would do a little criticizing behind his back. But this would be written off as the usual military dissatisfaction with civilian control. Then if there were another Bay of Pigs, the reaction of the country would be, is he too young and inexperienced? The military would almost feel that it was their patriotic obligation to stand ready to preserve the integrity of the nation. And only God knows just what segment of democracy they would be defending if they overthrew the elected establishment. Pausing a moment, he went on, then, if there were a third Bay of Pigs, it could happen. Waiting again until his listeners absorbed his meaning, he concluded with an old Navy phrase, but it won't happen on my watch. As we know, the young President John Kennedy did have a Bay of Pigs. The president bitterly disappointed the CIA and the military by deciding to accept defeat at the Bay of Pigs rather than escalate the battle. Kennedy realized after the fact that he had been drawn into a CIA scenario whose authors assumed he would be forced by circumstances to drop his advance restrictions against the use of U.S. combat forces. The CIA tried to trap Kennedy, as revealed by documents declassified 40 years later. Contrary to what the CIA told the president, they never expected the Cuban people to support the Cuban exiles led by CIA agents who invaded the Bay of Pigs. As news analyst Daniel Shore commented, the CIA's assumption was that President Kennedy, who had emphatically banned direct American involvement, would be forced by public opinion to come to the aid of the returning patriots. American forces, probably Marines, would come in to expand the beachhead. But as Kennedy said to two of his closest friends,
they couldn't believe a new president, like me, wouldn't panic and try to save his own face. Well, they had me figured all wrong.
John Kennedy reacted strongly to the CIA's pleading. When the enormity of the Bay of Pigs disaster came home to him, he said he wanted to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. In his own terms, John Kennedy did have a second Bay of Pigs. The president alienated the CIA and the military a second time by his decisions during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy secretly taped the White House meetings during the crisis. Their published transcripts, which we have today, reveal how isolated the president was in choosing to blockade further Soviet missile shipments rather than bomb and invade Cuba. Nowhere does he stand more alone against the pressures for a sudden, massive airstrike than in his October 19, 1962 meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In this encounter, the chief's disdain for their young commander-in-chief is summed up by Air Force Chief of Staff General Curtis LeMay when he says, "This blockade and political action is almost as bad as the appeasement of Hitler at Munich. I think that a blockade and political talk would be considered by a lot of our friends and neutrals as being a pretty weak response to this. And I'm sure a lot of our own citizens would feel that way, too. You're in a pretty bad fix, Mr. President." President Kennedy responds, "What did you say?" LeMay, "You're in a pretty bad fix." President Kennedy, with a mocking laugh, "You're in with me." As the meeting draws to a close, Kennedy rejects totally the Joint Chiefs' arguments for a quick, massive attack on Cuba. The president then leaves the room, But the tape keeps on recording. Two or three of the generals remain, and one says to LeMay, "You pulled the rug right out from under him. God damn." LeMay, with a chuckle, "Jesus Christ, what the hell do you mean?" Other general, "He finally got around to the word escalation. That's the only goddamn thing that's in the whole trick. Go in and get every goddamn one of the missiles. Escalation. That's it. Somebody's got to keep them from doing the goddamn thing piecemeal. That's our problem." The White House tapes show Kennedy questioning and resisting the mounting pressure to bomb Cuba coming from both the Joint Chiefs and the Executive Committee of the National Security Council. As in the case of the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis revealed the truth that President Kennedy's greatest conflict was not with any communist enemy. It was with his own national security state.
The unspeakable.
John Siegenthaler, who worked in President Kennedy's Department of Justice under JFK's brother, Robert Kennedy.
We were caught in the reality of the Cold War. The CIA had a role to play. But I don't think the Kennedys believed you could trust much of what they said. We were trying to find our way out of the Cold War, but the CIA certainly didn't want to.
As we have since learned, Kennedy and Khrushchev, like Thomas Merton, were writing their own desperate but somehow hopeful Cold War letters secretly to each other, even as they moved step by step toward a Cold War climax that would almost take the world over the edge with them. They were at the same time for over a year smuggling confidential letters back and forth that recognized each other's humanity and hoped for a solution. The first letter from Khrushchev to Kennedy was wrapped up in a newspaper. It was taken by a KGB agent to Kennedy's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, who gave him this newspaper for the president. Salinger said, "The president needs another newspaper." The man said, "Check inside." Inside was this 27-page letter from Khrushchev to Kennedy that had not been seen by Khrushchev's advisors and was not seen by Kennedy's advisors. Nikita Khrushchev, the atheist, said to Kennedy in his letter, "You know, we're on Noah's Ark. We're all on Noah's Ark. And let's not argue about who are the clean and who are the unclean on the Ark. We're all on the Ark in the nuclear age." They were enemies who, in the midst of the deepening turmoil, were learning something approaching trust in each other. Thus it came to pass that in the most decisive hour of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when both sides were falling into darkness, it was the moment at which the U-2 spy plane was shot down by Soviet surface-to-air missile, a point at which everyone around Kennedy, with the exception of his brother Robert, were pushing. Now there had to be retaliation. There had to be a taking out of the Soviet missiles before they could get the nuclear warheads on them. In fact, they already had them on them. If the attack had been made, that would have been total nuclear war at that moment. So thus it came to pass that at that moment, when they were falling into darkness, Nikita Khrushchev in Moscow turned to his foreign minister, who was Andrei Gromyko, and said something totally shocking. Khrushchev said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." After a short silence, inspired by the sense of his word help, Khrushchev repeated it to a wondering Gromyko, "Yes, help. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." What especially moved Khrushchev to help Kennedy by withdrawing the Soviet missiles from Cuba was Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin's description of his secret meeting with Robert Kennedy. The president's brother was exhausted. Dobrynin could see from Robert Kennedy's eyes that he hadn't slept for days. RFK told him the president didn't know how to resolve the situation. The military is putting great pressure on him, insisting on military actions against Cuba, and the president is in a very difficult position. Even if he doesn't want or desire a war, something irreversible could occur against his will. That is why the president is asking for help to solve this problem. In his memoirs, Khrushchev reported a further chilling sentence from Robert Kennedy's appeal to de Bruijnen. If the situation continues much longer, the president is not sure that the military will not overthrow him and seize power. Half a world apart, in radical ideological conflict, both Kennedy in his call for help and Khrushchev in his response had recognized their interdependence with each other and the world. They suddenly joined hands. When Khrushchev withdrew his Soviet missiles from Cuba, and Kennedy in turn pledged not to invade Cuba and secretly promised to withdraw U.S. missiles from Turkey, neither side won in the missile crisis. In fact, each leader made vital concessions to his Cold War opponent that dismayed the zealots in his own camp. John Kennedy's next Bay of Pigs, his next critical conflict with his military leaders and the CIA, was his American University address. Saturday Review editor Norman Cousins summed up the significance of this remarkable speech. At American University, on June 10, 1963, President Kennedy proposed an end to the Cold War.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time.
The military-industrial complex was totally dependent on a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. That Pax Americana, policed by the Pentagon, was considered the system's indispensable, hugely profitable means of containing and defeating communism.
Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men.
At great risk, Kennedy was rejecting the foundation of the Cold War system.
Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours.
He went on to unilaterally pledge never to test a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere again unless an opponent did. He said that he would do that as a way to extend trust toward the other side and to initiate the process for a nuclear test ban treaty. The Soviet press, which was accustomed to censoring U.S. government documents, published the entire speech all across the country. Soviet radio stations broadcast and rebroadcast the speech to the Soviet people. In response to Kennedy's turn toward peace, the Soviet government even stopped jamming all Western broadcasts into their country. Nikita Khrushchev was deeply moved by what Kennedy had said. He told test ban negotiator Averell Harriman that Kennedy had given the greatest speech by any American president since Roosevelt. Kennedy's speech was received less favorably in his own country. The New York Times reported his government's skepticism.
Generally, there was not much optimism in official Washington that the president's conciliation address at American University would produce agreement on a test ban treaty or anything else. In contrast to the Soviet media that were electrified by the speech, U.S. media ignored or downplayed it, and have to this very day. For the first time, Americans had less opportunity to read and hear the president's words than did the Russian people. A turnaround was occurring in the world on different levels. Whereas nuclear disarmament had suddenly become feasible, Kennedy's position in his own government had become precarious. As Thomas Merton had hoped and prayed, but thought unlikely, John Kennedy was turning much faster than was safe for a Cold War leader. By the end of August, the tide of congressional mail had gone from 15-1 against the test ban to 3-2 against. In the meantime, the president and his committee of activists were bucking the military-industrial complex, which had become alarmed at Kennedy's sudden turn toward peace and his alliance with peace activists in support of the test ban. The August 5, 1963 U.S. News and World Report carried a major article headlined, "Is U.S. giving up in the arms race?" The president's peacemaking had by now moved beyond any effective military control. In the test ban talks, the military weren't in the loop. Kennedy made a very quick end run around them to negotiate the treaty.
685.
Kennedy tried very hard to reassert the powers of the presidency as they had been exercised by Franklin D. Roosevelt. Generally speaking, the only president after Lincoln who really exercises the power of the presidency, who you can really say is president of the United States, is Roosevelt, Franklin. But then Kennedy attempts to return to these methods. And, of course, the oligarchy at that point says, well, we'll never allow another real president of the United States. We are an oligarchy. We are the rule of the few, the bankers, and we do not accept the idea that there can be a constitutional president who's more powerful than we are. And that's what Roosevelt was, and this is what they're permanently organized to stop. Even today, a lot of what they do is dictated by precisely these considerations, right? Why they prefer such weak puppet presidents, as the current one, people who can't think and so on down the line, can't resist what the bankers might want. However, they'd seen Kennedy try to assert the presidency, therefore he had to be liquidated.
On October 11, 1963, President Kennedy issued a top-secret order to begin withdrawing the U.S. military from Vietnam. In National Security Action Memorandum 263, he ordered that 1,000 U.S. military personnel be withdrawn from Vietnam by the end of 1963 and that all U.S. troops be taken out by the end of 1965. Kennedy decided on his withdrawal policy against the arguments of most of his advisors. After JFK's assassination, his withdrawal policy was quietly voided. In light of the future consequences of Dallas, it was not only John Kennedy who was murdered on November 22, 1963, but 58,000 other Americans and over 3 million Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians.
The unspeakable.
A month before going to Dallas, President Kennedy decided to create his own back channel to communicate with Fidel Castro, just as he had done with Nikita Khrushchev.
On November 23, 1963, the day after Kennedy's assassination, Fidel Castro gave a speech on Cuban radio and TV in which he analyzed the wire service reports the day before that had instantly identified Lee Harvey Oswald as the assassin. Castro asked brilliantly obvious questions about Oswald that have been suppressed in our own media for decades. He asked, "Can anyone who has said that he will disclose military secrets, as Oswald said to the Soviet Union, return to the United States without being sent to jail?" How strange that this former Marine should go to the Soviet Union and try to become a Soviet citizen, and that the Soviets should not accept him, that he should say at the American embassy that he intended to disclose to the Soviet Union the secrets of everything he learned while he was in the U.S. service, and then in spite of this statement, his passage home is paid by the U.S. government. He goes back to Texas and finds a job. That is all so strange. Fidel Castro recognized CIA written all over Lee Harvey Oswald and the press releases on him that were being sent around the world within minutes of the assassination. The whole Dallas setup was obvious to someone as familiar with CIA assassination plots as Fidel Castro was. Lee Harvey Oswald was a U.S. counterintelligence agent. His previous role as a fake defector to the Soviet Union from 1959 to 1962 made him an ideal patsy in the assassination. Prior to his false defection, Oswald was a U.S. Marine stationed in 1957-58 at the Atsugi Naval Air Station in Japan, where he was a radar operator for the CIA's top-secret U-2 spy plane. From his time at Atsugi, Oswald was a CIA operative under the effective control of the CIA's counterintelligence branch, directed by James Jesus Angleton. When Oswald returned from his so-called defection to the Soviet Union in 1962, instead of being prosecuted, he was given a U.S. government loan. When he settled in Dallas with his Russian wife Marina and infant daughter June, his closest friend and mentor was U.S. intelligence operative George de Morenshield. During the summer of 1963, Oswald acted out the role of a provocative pro-Castro demonstrator in New Orleans. While he must have thought his purpose was to discredit the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, he was in reality being set up by the CIA to be identified later as a pro-Castro assassin in Dallas. The plot originally called for JFK to be assassinated in Chicago on Saturday, November 2, 1963, when he was scheduled to attend a football game at Soldier Field. That was the day after South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother Nu were assassinated by a CIA plot in Saigon. The two CIA plots were likely being coordinated so that the Saigon murders could be blamed on President Kennedy, as they have been. Thus, it could be said in retrospect that Kennedy, from his supposedly ordering Diem's murder, got what he deserved in return. The Chicago plot to kill Kennedy has been exposed by former Secret Service agent Abraham Bolden, whose own book has just been published on this subject. And as a result, Abraham Bolden served 45 months in federal prison on trumped-up charges. The plot has also been investigated by journalist Edwin Black, the author of a series of classic books today on the Holocaust. The Chicago Secret Service apprehended two members of a four-man sniper team on the eve of Kennedy's scheduled trip. The men were then simply released. They vanished with no record of their arrest or identity ever found. Intelligence officers in the Chicago Police Department arrested at the same time Thomas Arthur Valley, a disturbed young man who had reportedly threatened to kill Kennedy. He bore the characteristics of a scapegoat. Thomas Arthur Valley was like Lee Harvey Oswald, an ex-Marine who had been stationed at a U-2 base in Japan, who worked later with the CIA as a paramilitary trainer, and who currently had a job located in a building directly over President Kennedy's scheduled parade route in Chicago. Valley's workplace, which I visited and looked down from, and has exactly the same perspective as from the Texas School Book Depository's sixth floor, that would have been actually even closer to JFK's limousine than Oswald's workplace. If Kennedy's trip to Chicago had not been canceled at the very last possible moment, you and I would likely never have heard of Lee Harvey Oswald. Thomas Arthur Valley would instead be remembered as the notorious assassin after being scapegoated and killed himself with the actual snipers allowed to escape, as they were in both Chicago and Dallas. When the Secret Service drove JFK slowly into Dealey Plaza in Dallas and brought his limousine to a virtual stop, the president had been stripped of his security. The Secret Service agents who normally stood on the sides of his limousine to shield him from gunfire had been withdrawn to a car driven behind him. The police motorcycle escorts who also served to shield him had been similarly pulled back behind him, so they provided no barrier.
And there is a YouTube video that I've seen, I shall link to it from this show's webpage, of a nonplussed member of the security service who tries to assume his customary position on the corner of the limousine and is waved away, presumably by a supervisor.
Sniper teams went unchallenged as they took their positions in open windows above Dealey Plaza and behind the barriers at the top of the grassy knoll. The snipers, who carried not only rifles but also phony Secret Service credentials to ensure their escape, executed the president with crossfire from the grassy knoll, the Texas School Book Depository, and probably additional building and drainpipe locations. That night, military authorities controlled and falsified the autopsy at the Bethesda Naval Hospital in Maryland. Fraudulent x-rays and pictures were created. The Warren Commission then followed President Johnson's lead in backing away from the CIA's overly obvious claims of Cuban and Soviet involvement, which would have implicated the CIA itself, and indicted the dead scapegoat, Oswald, as only a lone assassin. And I apologize for summarizing 300 pages of evidence in three paragraphs. But anyhow, JFK was deeply conscious of the risks he was taking for peace. He was not afraid of death. As a biographer observed, Kennedy talked a great deal about death and about the assassination of Lincoln. His conscious model for struggling truthfully through conflict and being ready to die as a consequence was Abraham Lincoln. On the day when Kennedy and Khrushchev resolved the missile crisis, JFK told his brother Robert, referring to the assassination of Lincoln, "This is the night I should go to the theater." Robert replied, "If you go, I want to go with you." They would both go soon. Kennedy prepared himself for the same end Lincoln met during his night at the theater, as we saw from Presidential Secretary Evelyn Lincoln's midnight discovery of the slip of paper JFK had written on. He had adopted Lincoln's prayer, "I know there is a God and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready." For at least a decade, JFK's favorite poem had been Rendezvous, a celebration of death. Rendezvous was by Alan Seeger, an American poet killed in World War I. The poem was Seeger's affirmation of his own anticipated death. The refrain of Rendezvous, "I have a rendezvous with death," articulated John Kennedy's deep sense of his own mortality. Kennedy had experienced a continuous rendezvous with death in anticipation of his actual death, from the deaths of his PT boat crew members, from drifting alone in the dark waters of the Pacific Ocean, from the early deaths of his brother Joe and sister Kathleen, and from the recurring near-death experiences of his almost constant illnesses. John Kennedy's decision to turn toward peace, regardless of the consequences to himself, is reason for gratitude. I think of him with gratitude, especially on Thanksgiving Day, which always falls around the anniversary of his assassination. Last Thanksgiving, November 22, 2007, coincided with the 44th anniversary of the gift of his life. Had JFK not turned and given his life, I believe the world would now be a nuclear wasteland. The fact that he did turn and was therefore
murdered by an unspeakable power which continues to rule us today, raises profound questions about our need to face the same darkness, to turn toward our own miracle of peace, and to accept the consequences as he did. It is our story, a story of hope.
Now, mindful of the unspeakable which he is researching, I particularly appreciate the positive note taken by Jim Douglas there. And just to clarify, if it's not obvious to you by now, that I'm not seeking in making this to get justice in the punitive sense. That's not the type of closure that I'm looking for. I'm making this out of a spirit of full disclosure. I think that the truth must be told. If I'm not mistaken, it was Martin Luther King who commented that there comes a time when silence is betrayal. I'm looking forward to a world beyond self-interest, a world beyond enemy images. Remember the vital role, the fear of the Cold War in securing cooperation for the CIA, that expression of anxiety, that determination to get what corporations wanted, whatever the human cost. I believe that 2019, it's high time we spoke the unspeakable. And I don't believe violence is needed, because I don't believe that this system, by which I mean the supranational deep state and the fictitious story of global democracy, corporate consumerist utopia with which it has enthralled a lot of people worldwide, I don't believe that that system really has anything useful to offer people. I think that all that is needed is for us to see the world as it is and to have the courage to act accordingly. And on the subject of courage, we're going to have a section of new material to the show from one of the most outspoken researchers into the JFK assassination and US deep politics from the pre-internet era. This is Mae Brussell, who produced hundreds of hours of audio cassettes and mailed them out to her listeners as another creative way of using technology to share the truth. And the vintage of her material can perhaps be inferred from the fact that she uses the word conspiracy in the title. So she hails from an era before the word conspiracy was so concertedly attacked and associated with craziness by the corporate media. More details on that at episode 658, if you feel the need to look that one up.
This is Mae Brussell. It's October 16th, 1977, and this dialogue, conspiracy number 291. I received a long letter from a woman who's a regular listener to Dialogue Conspiracy in Sacramento, and she asked me a question which I get sometimes on other radio shows and in the mail. She asked me, why worry about the murder of John Kennedy that I dwell upon so much, that people assume that there's a conspiracy there, and go on to other important problems, she said. In fact, John Kennedy is dead. You can get into a rut, and you can go into other matters. And the answer that I want to give her on the air expresses my feelings about why I go into the John Kennedy assassination so much. As far as I'm concerned, it epitomizes the transference in the United States of power in a way that obviously implicates all the major agencies of the federal and state government. This came out at the time of Watergate, but it was very obvious at the time John Kennedy was killed that the CIA is involved, the FBI is involved, the State Department, the Internal Revenue Service, Immigration Department, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the new President of the United States, the Chiefs of Police, the Governor of Texas, the District Attorney in Texas, the Sheriff's Department, the Attorney General. All agencies that touched the matter were part of a cover-up. The entire news media, the press, the national media, the Associated Press, United Press, CBS, NBC, Reuters, Radio Free Europe, U.S. Information Service have all been the tools of the CIA. And nothing was more flagrant or obvious than at the time John Kennedy was killed. The Washington Post, the New York Times, Saturday Evening Post, these newspapers have been named in Rolling Stones and new CIA documents as being part of a large branch of the Central Intelligence Agency, all the major media of the United States, starting in 1947. It's so flagrant in the John Kennedy assassination that if they could do this over the murder of a president, they will distort any other news, whether it's kidnappings or stock market affairs or regarding our health or pollution or any other matter. The same people that were involved in the killing of John Kennedy and covering it up, such as Alan Dulles, who was director of the CIA and then on the Warren Commission, also were part of forming our news media after World War II that became the tool of the Central Intelligence Agency and didn't belong to the people. The same people are involved in altering our minds surgically, electronically, through drugs. They're polluting our rivers, our oceans. They're making people impotent and sterile through their chemicals, importing massive narcotics into the cities and into the schools. They can kill off political opponents all over the world, and they're doing it every week. The head of Yemen and his brother were killed this week when they were making overtures somewhat to the left in their country. They can arm Africa and Middle East and turn it into a bloodbath like they did in Vietnam. And when it was over, they said Vietnam was an error. And I believe that the culprits into all of these things have names and that they are linked over and over again to the John Kennedy assassination. Then they appear through the history of through Watergate, and the same culprits are at work. An example is that Scripps Howard correspondent Seth Cantor, who was in Dallas at the time John Kennedy was killed at 2:45, he calls his Washington office, and he gets a message from Hal Hendricks in Miami. And Hal Hendricks already knows about Lee Harvey Oswald before anyone else. He identifies him by name. He tells the major media he's a Castroite. And then later, Hendricks is identified as a CIA agent who becomes a top executive for ITT. And then he later goes on to Chile at the time of the coup when Salvador Allende was murdered. So that these dogs don't stop with one foot, they keep going on. I read this week that Salvador Allende's daughter commits suicide, Beatrice Allende, over the death of her father. Maybe she killed herself with a gun. Maybe she was killed in silence. They said that she's been depressed since her father died. There's also a news bulletin that the American journalists are investigating the death of Charles Horman, who was in Chile at the time that Allende was killed, and he was murdered down there. And the list of deaths on the hands of these people runs into the hundreds and maybe the thousands, not counting the war deaths after the escalation of Vietnam. So the answer, why do I keep pursuing the killing of John Kennedy? Because there are many people alive who are still overthrowing governments, lying, polluting, and stealing from us. And when we investigate this assassination thoroughly and then go to the murder of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy and into the Chappaquiddick affair or the shooting of George Wallace and further into Watergate, maybe we can purge ourselves of these people so that we can get on to the business of doing the things that we should be doing and enjoying on planet Earth.
Call me an incurable optimist if you like, but I believe that Mae Brussel lays it out there, an entirely reasonable goal, in my opinion, to try to rid ourselves of these people, who are, after all, a tiny fraction of humanity, who are in charge of the demolition of the world's ecosystem, unspeakable suffering, left, right and centre. I think there's a lot of good arguments for why, in the world of 2019, the time has come for a big change. I think, conversely, anyone who says, oh, Kennedy assassination, ancient history, not relevant to the world of today, is somebody who has missed the important truth that the same principles at work then are still at work. I think it's totally unreasonable to try to tackle the problems of the environment without facing up to the reality that the so-called political leaders are firstly not leaders and secondly not representative of the will of the people. The question of how to tackle this is an important one. We're going to get onto that later. We now continue with a section from the drama, The Unspeakable, with an obvious resonance to cases such as the death of David Kelly today. Studying history should yield an insight into the still present reality that the unspeakable, the supranational deep state, continues to cover its tracks by exerting fear over individuals with whom it comes into contact.
We live under an increasingly global reign of terror, but our disconnection from the meaning is its triumph.
Lieutenant Colonel Pierre Fink was the army doctor who assisted Dr. Humes in the autopsy. Colonel Fink was questioned under oath about the president's autopsy.
Colonel Fink, was Dr. Humes running the show?
Well, I heard Dr. Humes say, "Who's in charge here?" And I heard an army general, I don't remember his name, stating, "I am."
How many other military personnel were present in the autopsy room?
The room was crowded with military and civilian personnel and federal agents. Secret Service agents, FBI agents.
Navy medical corpsman Paul O'Connor was also in the autopsy room.
It got very tense. Admiral Galloway started getting very agitated about the wound in his neck. And I remember the doctors were going to check that out when Admiral Galloway told them, "Leave it alone. Don't touch it. It's just a tracheotomy." He stopped anybody from going further. Doctors Humes and Boswell, Dr. Fink, were told to leave it alone.
Dr. Fink refused to answer several questions related to the track of the bullet in President Kennedy's neck.
I will ask you the question one more time. Why did you not dissect the track of the bullet wound that you have described today and you saw at the time of the autopsy, at the time you examined the body?
As I recall, I was told not to, but I don't remember by whom.
James Jenkins, who also assisted in the autopsy, confirmed that the doctors were obeying military orders.
In retrospect, I think doing the autopsy in Bethesda rather than at Parkland Hospital in Dallas was a controlling factor. They could control Humes, Boswell, and Fink because they were military. And if we weren't controlled, we could be punished, and that kept us away from the public. From that point on, I have had no trust, no respect for the government.
Charles Crenshaw, Parkland Hospital doctor.
There was a conspiracy of silence. I believe there was a common denominator in our silence, a fearful perception that to come forward with what we believe to be the medical truth would be asking for trouble. Although we never admitted it to one another, we realized that the inertia of the established story was so powerful, so thoroughly presented, so adamantly accepted, that it would bury anyone who stood in its path. I was as afraid of the men in suits as I was of the men who had assassinated the president. I reasoned that anyone who would go so far as to eliminate the president of the United States would surely not hesitate to kill a doctor.
Now, the following is a section of an audiobook that I produced entitled 50 Years of the Deep State. I'm reading an unfinished essay by Mark Gorton, which was posted on the internet after the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. That's available as a standalone audiobook, and I used that material to make episodes 685 and 686. The Quickening of the Cabal. The criminals who took over the government had an incredible fear of being exposed. If exposed, they would be hung for treason. Fear of exposure bound the network behind the coup of 63 into an incredibly powerful political force which has dominated the American federal political system for the last 50 years. The assassination continues to be an important event that every American should take the time to understand, because the powerful forces that seized control of our government 50 years ago have not let go. As I studied the coup of 63, I began to perceive this cabal behind JFK's assassination, and as I've studied their actions, I've understood their desperate need to control the American political system. If the cabal were ever to lose control of the American political system, they risk exposure for a litany of crimes which continue to this present day. 6 years ago, I started studying the JFK assassination out of curiosity, but as I came to understand the coup of 63, and I was able to perceive the cabal behind the coup as an incredible political force, I began to study a series of events. Many of these events were also conspiracies, dismissed as crazy by the mainstream media, and I saw that these conspiracies were the work of the same network of people. And what I've been doing for the last several years has been tracking the work of this evolving cabal through time. In order to escape justice for their heinous crimes, the cabal needed to build a number of capabilities for themselves. The cabal needed to be able to kill with impunity anyone who threatened to expose them. They needed to be able to control the press. They needed to control the presidency, federal law enforcement agencies, and the intelligence community. Operating under the secret cover of national security from within the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the ONI, military intelligence, etc., the cabal has been able to systematically destroy threats to itself. With control of the FBI, Justice Department, DEA, ATF, etc., the cabal has been able to ensure that no serious investigation into its crimes would take place. And massive, highly successful programs to control the press, like the CIA's Operation Mockingbird, have ensured that the mainstream media would systematically ignore and dismiss all claims of high-level government corruption. With the control of law enforcement, intelligence agencies, and the press, the cabal built itself the perfect machine for committing crimes and getting away with them. And with these capabilities, the cabal has run amok for the last 50 years. The assassination of RFK. The RFK assassination gives a good idea of the capability of this system. Bobby Kennedy knew that his brother had been killed by a conspiracy. He had a vague sense of the outlines of this conspiracy, but trapped within the Johnson administration, he lacked the power to determine the truth for sure. Bobby's plan was to wait until he could attain the presidency, and then, with the full power of the presidency, he would relentlessly hunt down his brother's killers and avenge JFK's death. The cabal could not allow RFK to become president, and from the moment they seized power, they worked relentlessly to build the mechanism to let them kill Bobby Kennedy and cover up the truth behind his killing. The cabal acquired a variety of mechanisms to kill their enemies. One such mechanism was to use special forces operatives from the U.S. military who'd been trained to obey orders unquestioningly, and once told that someone was an enemy of the state, they would ignorantly and dutifully dispatch this person. Since World War II, the Mafia and the CIA had developed a close, mutually supportive relationship. In many cases, mob hitmen could be deployed on behalf of their intelligence and political masters. Within the CIA and other intelligence organizations were